Calling state affairs back to order at 2:11 p.m. Friday, March 20. And we are taking up consideration of House Bill 190, PFD allowable absences, which we've heard previously in this committee from Representative Tallarico. As has been communicated to committee members, there's a CS for House Bill 190 that I've worked with Representative Tallarico on that I'm going to propose adopting as the working document. And then we also have two, possibly three amendments for consideration on that CS that we'll also consider. So I will make a motion to adopt the CS version S as the working document.
I'll object.
Okay, or let's make the motion formally.
Okay, I thought you just did.
No, Representative Fields.
I can make the motion. I move the committee adopt the CS to HB 190/31-LS1273/S.
And I'll object.
Great, thank you, Representative Thompson. I would do the same so we can run through it. 190 version S is a CS I worked on with Representative Tallarico. This makes a number of changes as described in the explanation of changes, version A to version S. Effectively, this sets a 120-day limit on how many days you can be out of state per year and collect the PFD, as is described in Section 3 and also Section 4. And then there's a separate section of PFD eligibility that if you qualify under an eligible absence, you can continue to collect your PFD even if you're not physically in Alaska year after year after year after year, provided that you come back to Alaska every 2 years for 72 hours, so basically 3 days, and then also provided that you were cumulatively in Alaska every 5 years for 30 cumulative days. And so if you're collecting PFDs while qualifying under an eligible absence for whatever reason, provided you're back every 2 years for 72 hours and back every 5 years for 30 cumulative days, you can continue to collect those PFDs. So the changes in the CS in Section 1 and Section 4 increase the 2 year 72 hour limit to 7 consecutive days as a minimum, and then in Section 4 increases the 30 cumulative days every 5 years to 90 cumulative days that you have to be in Alaska. Any questions?
Yes.
Representative Thompson.
You know, I like the original bill, but I think this muddies it up a lot. Let's say I'm in the Army. I own a house in Fairbanks. I have been stationed away from Alaska, and I'm still eligible. This changes it to where I can fly back. I mean, before, I could fly back to Alaska, and this changes it from having to be here for 72 hours to making it 7 days. And that's the Army guy that's coming back to live here. He owns a house. His kids are going to go to UAF. And you depend on their PFDs, and they're using that to get ready to go to college. And now all of a sudden, they have to be here for 7 consecutive days instead of just 72 hours. I don't think that's fair to a military guy. I can understand it on other cases, but I think that this one is. I don't like that particular way of doing it.
Thank you, Representative Thompson. Other questions or comments from the committee on the CS?
I've got more.
Go for it, Representative Thompson. Unload them all.
Okay, so this reduces travel for settling in a state. Let's say you got to go outside and settle in a state. It changes that you can be gone for 180 days down to 120 days. And this also reduces snowbird travel from 180 days to 120 days. I think we're... I don't know. That just doesn't seem fair also. I got more.
Representative Thompson, you can keep going. You're right. The part of the policy implications of this is if you are out of Alaska for upwards of half of the year. Presently, you can collect PFD, and with passage of the CS, if you're out of Alaska half the year, you no longer would be able to collect a PFD. So snowbirds who are here for 181 days a year would no longer be able to collect.
Your section, in
Representative Thompson.
In section 4, it states that in each of the five preceding years, it has to be here 120. It changes 180 to 120. What happens if they've been here and they have gone out and the last couple of years they exceeded 120? They've been receiving a PFD. Since they, for the five previous years, were following the old rules, are they now denied as a result of this change because of the 5 years?
Representative Thompson, can you restate the question?
Okay. What happens to those who have had 180 days of allowable absence over the last couple of years, and now we're changing it to 120 days, but they were gone for 180 days for a couple of years? Are they now ineligible as a result of this change?
Representative Thompson, which in the explanation of changes, which change are you referring to?
Section 4 reduces the number of allowable absent days in each of the five previous qualifying years from 180 to 120 for 5 years, or the prior 5 years. So if you have, over the last 3 years, been gone for 170 days, you're eligible and get it. But now you have to have been here over the last 5 years, 120 is the thing. So now they've been collecting it. Now you're saying that they're going to be denied because of the old rules are now changed? Is that fair?
Yeah, I can answer that question. Sure. The answer is yes. So presently, you can be gone half the year and you can qualify for a PFD. Under the CS, you have to be in Alaska for two-thirds of the year to collect a PFD. If you're in Alaska less than two-thirds of the year, then you will not collect a PFD.
But this goes back over a five-year period. So for 3 years, I was gone for 170 days. Now you're saying I have to have been here 120 for the last 5 years. So, right?
Representative Shaw, do you have an answer to Representative?
So I think what Representative Thompson is talking about, if you're here, if you live here for 5 years, in the first 3 years prior to this being enacted, you've been here for 170 days, you still have 2 years left now that you've come into the enaction of this legislation. So you've moved from 3 years of collecting PFDs with 170 days, and now this is enacted, you still have... Is that going to count against you for the next 2 years?
Representative Shaw, Representative Thompson, I think I get the question. So Section 4, and I'm going to lean on Emily Nauman because as her and I have discussed, the PFD eligibility statutes are incredibly convolutedly written. But so Section 4 refers to people who are out of state a lot and they're qualifying for PFDs under eligible absences. And it basically says that if you're out of state for more than half the year, for many years, after 5 years, you have to log a certain amount of time in Alaska in order to still qualify under your eligible absence. And so I think the answer to your question, Representative Thompson, is no, you would still be able to qualify for the PFD so long as that every 5 years, you spend 90 days cumulatively here, and you spend at least 7 consecutive days in Alaska every 2 years. But before there's any more comments, I'm going to bring on Emily Nauman off the line. Ms. Nauman, can you hear us?
Yes, I'm here.
I think we're in the rat's nest of this part of the PFD eligibility statutes. Did you follow Representative Thompson's question and my attempt at an answer?
Oh, boy, I hope I did. through the chair to Representative Thompson and to Chair Christ Tompkins, I think you're on the right track. If I could add something, and I would say that it would depend in part on how the Department of Revenue interprets this law change. I think part of Representative Thompson's question was whether or not someone who had been absent for 180 days, say for the past 2 years, or maybe for the past 4 years, whether or not the standard would suddenly change, and those years prior that they had been absent for 180 days would sort of become ineligible looking back now that the new standard is 120 days. And I think that's likely how the Department of Revenue would interpret this, that someone who had been gone 170 days for each of the, for 4 years would suddenly be ineligible under the new 120 day standard. An option could be, and there's a qualification to that that Representative Chris Tompkins eloquently explained. I will say that if the committee wishes to amend that interpretation, applicability language could easily be added to the bill to give those people that had been gone 180 days in the preceding 5 years sort of a grace period to get back on the 120-day track. I will say that under 43-2308D, which is the section we're talking about, the 120-day absence is a presumption that the individual is no longer a state resident, and as Representative Chris Tompkins said, the individual could rebut that presumption by demonstrating they were physically present in the state for 90 days in the past 5 years, and that they're a state resident meeting the qualifications of 43-23-295.
Thank you, and Ms. Nauman, I think that last part was what I was attempting to communicate. So Representative Thompson, in the scenario you describe, if somebody was gone for 170 years and we pass this and this becomes the new law, 120 days is the new standard, they can still qualify for the PFD so long as they satisfy the 90 cumulative days every 5 years and 7 consecutive days every 2 year requirement. If they fail to pass those two tests, then yes, they would in fact get kicked out of eligibility. But if they can at least show they've been here for 90 cumulative days every 5 years and 7 consecutive days every 2 years, they would continue to qualify. So it's like it's a really weird provision of the PFD eligibility statutes. And Emily Nauman, I just want to go back to you to confirm that what I just said was accurate, because I don't want to be getting this wrong.
Chair Chris Tompkins, that's correct. I think that we could think of the main body of 43-2308D as sort of a additional paperwork trigger. This might be the time the Department of Revenue takes notice of the fact that you've been gone and requires additional proof that you are a resident of the state and you intend to remain one, and applies those additional standards that you described.
Representative Thompson.
Okay. Also then in Section 4, it states that you're changing this from 30 cumulative days to 90 cumulative days. Again, how does this affect people who have been receiving PFDs under the current law? Will they now be ineligible for PFDs?
Representative Thompson, the answer is yes. So right now, under this provision that currently exists in law, if you're out of state through these eligible absences for more than 5 years, you've never qualified for a PFD through time spent in the state, but you're qualifying through an eligible absence. After 5 years, the state says, okay, we want you to basically prove up that you really live in Alaska, that you really have residency, you really have intent to be here. And that's where these two requirements come in, that you have to be in Alaska for at least 30 cumulative days every 5 years and 72 hours every 2 years, which from my perspective is almost laughably light. To be here 72 hours every 2 years and 30 cumulative days every 5 years, that's less than a week a year, which if you're a resident of Alaska, you claim to be. I sure well hope you're satisfying that. So the answer to your question is absolutely yes. If you can't be here for 90 cumulative days every 5 years, in the view of the CS, you're not collecting a PFD. Representative Hopkins.
Thank you. And this might be a question for Ms. Nauman. If this passes in the way that these two changes in Section 4, and say we have enough time in the legislature this year to get this bill all the way through and it passes, would those impact the dividends for people who would be receiving them this October who have already applied this year or maybe applying in the next few weeks before the expiration is done?
For the record, this is Emily with Legislative Legal Services. Through the chair to Representative Hopkins, the applicability language on page 4, lines 29 and 30, state that the changes made by the bill will apply for qualification for a permanent fund dividend paid in 2021 next year. In other words, these qualification requirements will apply to the current year, 2020, for the dividend that's paid out in 2021. And I apologize if I just made that more confusing. But the answer to your question in the straightforward way is no.
All right. Thank you very much. And follow up. So if we changed that line on page 4 that just fell out of my hands to 2022, people would be able to arrange their travel and life plans for next year in order to get the dividend, that, or in order to apply themselves to these two Section 4 changes. So if we pushed it back a year, they'd have the knowledge next year of how many hours and how many months they would have to be here overall in order to get or not to get the dividend in 2022, I guess.
Through the chair to Representative Hopkins, that's correct.
All right, thank you.
Other questions? Representative Thompson.
Yeah, I wanted to follow back up about the military person that have to be here for 7 consecutive days. They're a registered voter in Fairbanks. They own a house in Fairbanks. They are going to retire to Fairbanks. They pay property tax in Fairbanks, but they aren't out of the Army yet. They're about to retire, but they're getting close. Now, this says that they have to come up and be here for 7 consecutive days instead of the 72-hour requirement. I can understand where this is going with it, but is that fair to somebody that's in the military and they want to be a resident? They are a resident, basically, in their mind, because they've never changed their residency. This is penalizing a few of those. Now, I have no problem with trying to figure out how some of this goes, because there are a lot of military with kids that have no intention of ever coming back to Alaska, and they continue to collect these checks every year, and I've always complained about that. But at the same time, you've got some people that are definitely going to be injured by this. I just didn't like that.
Representative Thompson, yeah, I think it's a good point, and I mean, you're right. I think there's, you know, a certain portion of military, and it can be other people who are collecting under eligible absences who are not physically in Alaska for 360 days of the year, but you know they're qualifying under some eligible absence, and they're doing it year after year, and you know this provision may make it difficult for them to qualify for the PFD. I think basically what this does is sort of it really ask people to prove up that they're serious about Alaska, and if they can show that they can be here for 1 consecutive week every 2 years, then, you know, that's the, hey, I'm serious about Alaska. And, you know, presumably if somebody owns a house, they might have a week of housework or whatever the thing might be. But I think it just sort of asks people to show that they're serious, that this is their home and not just gone 365 days out of the year, except for 1 3-day weekend every 2 years, and continuing to collect PFD for themselves and their family. I mean, you're right. There is a give take, and I might turn to Ann Westgate, the PFD division, just because I think she's familiar with this provision. And Ms. Westgate, I just want to ask if, first of all, if my answer to Representative Thompson's question was right, or if there's anything you have to add to what you've heard in terms of clarifying how all these rules work.
Thank you so much. For the record, this is Ann Westke, Permanent Fund Dividend Division Director. Chairman, you have described it fairly accurately. I did want to add a little bit of information. One is just that the concern is, I keep hearing, like, if they were gone for, you know, 120 days or 170 days, this would really mostly apply for individuals who are gone for over 358 days a year. That would be the it's a pretty small population. In fact, now that I get to work in my office, I'm able to research numbers while people are talking. So I did find that it applies to roughly 825 applicants a year that fall within this five-year rule. So it would be individuals who are gone really for a very significant amount of time, again, more like 358 days a year. If they're gone for more than that each year, they would want to make sure that they're really, well, one of the years they'd be gone for the entire year, and then the next year they would want to make sure they were in the state for at least 7 days, according to this version. But I just want to make sure that we kind of recognize the extremes on this one.
Thank you, Ms. Wesky. Other questions? Representative Thompson?
Yeah, going to Section 3, you know, if somebody had to go out and take care of their family estate, it might take longer than 120 days to settle. Is there some way to figure out it's 180 days now. But if somebody's having to go out and take care of their family estate, you know, their parents' home and all of their belongings, and they're having to sell all this stuff and all kinds of problems, and if they can't go past 120 days, there's no forgiveness for trying to take care of family matters. That's the way I'm reading that.
And I can take a first crack at that, Representative Thompson, and I'm going to again ask Ms. Wesky to see if I got anything wrong. I'm actually just working from memory. I should grab the statute book, but I think there's actually an eligible absence for settling estate, so it doesn't count against you. So you can all the time that you're taking for settling a family's estate doesn't detract from your days in Alaska. And then on top of all the days, say your parents lived in Michigan and you're back, you have to go to Michigan to settle the estate for 130 days a year, or when they pass away. I think that's a separate eligible absence, and under the CS, you would get an additional 120 days on top of those 130 days before you would actually get removed from eligibility, because those days for the eligible absence don't count against you because they're an eligible absence. But I'm going to turn to Ms. Wesky because I'm working from memory on this one. Ms. Wesky?
Mr. Chairman, that is correct.
Okay, that's what I was wanting to find out, if there was an allowable absence.
Yeah, and just to clarify, I think so when we're going to 120 days, allowable absences don't count against your quota of time you have to spend in Alaska, so you can stack your days outside Alaska, if you will, and they can end up being quite a lot in some situations. But other questions from the committee?
Go ahead.
Representative Vance?
Since we're on Section 3, would you clarify the need for the Marmite Registered Apprenticeship Program?
I'll let Representative Field speak to that, because I believe he's yes. Taken the point on working
Thank
with
you.
Representative Tallarico.
Mr. Chairman, I will be introducing an amendment, number one, because maritime is often confused with Marmite, which is a revolting thing that British people put on bread, and we can't have that kind of confusion in our statute books. Number two, because it might unintentionally exclude other registered apprenticeship programs. So the background here, there could be multiple ways. Okay, stepping back, the background is registered apprenticeship exists under the National Apprenticeship Act, also known as the Fitzgerald Act, which has governed post-secondary industry-funded training programs since 1937. Alaska actually has some of the strongest apprenticeship programs in the country. Maritime registered apprenticeships are funded by TOTE, MATSA, and other carriers. And the way it works is Alaskans go to school, and there is a physical school, the Paul Hall Training Academy in Maryland, and they do what's called their didactic instruction there, equivalent to sitting in a college classroom. The on-the-job training takes place in the waters of Alaska and all over the world, because, of course, these are international shipping companies. In 2014, the Department of Revenue promulgated some regulations that I think are actually kind of in conflict with the underlying statutes. That's a debatable point. However, following issuance of those regulations, the Alaska Commission on Postsecondary Education said that because the this Maritime Register Apprenticeship Program, it's with the Seafarers Union and these numerous companies, because the apprenticeship program is not subject to receive financial aid, these students cannot receive a PFD. Now, keep in mind, students who go to Cal Maritime and Maine Maritime, which are tuition-based training institutions that lead to the exact same maritime credentials, they are eligible to receive PFDs. So to me, there's an element of absurdity where effectively we're discriminating against industry-funded training programs that are registered apprenticeship vis-a-vis tuition-funded programs at Cal and Maine Maritime. That should not have been a problem until these 2014 regulations, which I'm sure DOR never thought of this when they promulgated them, but unfortunately they were construed in such a way by Commission on Postsecondary Education as to potentially exclude participants in the Seafarers program. I also think it's worth noting the Seafarers program actually has a long history in the state of Alaska. Many years ago, Congressman Young was talking with some of the shippers about the program, and he said, God, this is a great program. Your boats are in our waters all the time. I want you to get more Alaskans on these boats. And the shippers took him seriously. They have full-time recruiting staff in the state of Alaska in Ketchikan, and there are, at this point, families who now have as many as three generations of people who have gone through the Register Apprenticeship Program for these large shippers. Former Senator Stevens was a huge supporter of this program. So anyway, I just mention that history because I think, you know, look, there are only a handful of participants who this is going to affect. But given the longstanding interest from this state in registered apprenticeship and the apparent inability of the Commission on Postsecondary Education to construe current language and statute in a rational way, I think we have to fix it in statute. Hence the amendment. And if you look at the amendment, what it does is just say that if you're participating in a registered apprenticeship program, you're not going to be discriminated against. If you turn to the beginning of Section 3, you can see subject to BND of the section, an otherwise eligible individual who is absent during the state in the qualifying year remains eligible if the individual is absent receiving secondary or post-education on a full-time basis. Number two, receiving vocational, professional, or other specific education on a full-time basis, which, as determined by ACPE, a comparable program is not reasonably available in the state. So number two is sort of the crux of the matter on ACPE construing both the statute and regulations too narrowly. ACPE says the participants can only get a PFD if it's a, like I said, a program which receives financial aid. The fact is, Mattson and Tote's program doesn't receive financial aid because guess what? They pay for it. That's a good thing. We shouldn't discriminate against these students. And that is the very long and complicated background to the amendment.
And I might ask Ms. Weske to also to comment on if there's anything to add to Representative Vance's question about the Maritime Registered Apprenticeships.
Thank you for the record. This is Ann again with PFD. Through the chair, so we are working on this. This is a hot topic for us as well, and we're working with the Department of Law on finding a remedy to the situation. We do recognize the schools that have the school that we're aware of at this time that came forward. We do recognize them as what appears to be a very credible school. And so we're trying to find some ways to make this a possibility. I think that with that, we also have to be careful of not opening it up too large. And so I think specifying, the maritime career path is probably a really wise decision in this. But I don't have anything significant at this time to add, as we're literally in the middle of working with Department of Law as well to in support of what Representative Fields has stated.
If I might make one comment.
Thank you, Director Weske. Representative Fields.
And I appreciate that comment. I think we do have to be careful because, you know, for a while, the federal government squandered a lot of money on for-profit training programs that didn't have good outcomes. And, you know, we want to be really careful not to inadvertently, you know, encourage participants to go outside the state to a for-profit training program that's not actually connected to a job down the lower 48 somewhere. That would be a perverse outcome. That's not what I intend, and that's why the language specifically says registered apprenticeship, because under federal definitions of apprenticeship, it has to be connected to employment, guaranteeing that we're not going to inadvertently be subsidizing some kind of, you know, bottom feeder for-profit education program. So by the structure of the amendment, it does have those protections built in there. And thanks, Ms. Weske, for pointing that out, because it's an important point.
Representative Hopkins, do you have a question?
Thank you. Yeah. Director Weske, do we, since you guys are aware of this problem and working on it, do we have any idea of how many Alaskans are currently in this program?
Through the chair, at this time, we have recognized two individuals who this is affecting. I'm not fully aware of the total number. Just a second. Let me see. It looks like we have no, you know what? I wouldn't know. I'm sorry. I'm looking at the Merchant Marine actual absence for the career. But as far as the schooling goes, I don't know, because they wouldn't have had an opportunity to really note that specifically in a way that we can pull that data element, because it's never been considered before. So we don't have a separate data element for that.
Thank you. Representative Fields, do you have any idea on that number?
My understanding is it is in the range of two, very small number of people.
All right, thank you.
Other questions? Representative Thompson?
Yeah, I just, this is kind of a remote thought, but at the same time, do we need anything added into this bill that would be allowable absences for people displaced by COVID-19?
It's a good question, Representative Thompson. I think Representative Vance has an amendment on that that just hot off the presses from Ledgely. You ask and you shall receive. Yes, great question.
And Mr. Chairman, on that point.
Representative Fields.
I guess I would ask Ms. Weske, to what extent does subsection 5 and section 3 receiving continuous medical treatment address this issue potentially on COVID-19.
And just keep in mind, I don't think Director Weske at this moment, although we can remedy this, has the benefit of seeing amendment number 3 unless Representative Vance's.
Through the chair, I did print it off. I found it. Again, one of the few perks of not being there with you guys is I can do a little bit work here, and I did find it online and printed it. So I believe I'm on the same page as you guys now.
Oh, great. Please proceed.
With that being said, I haven't fully read through all of it as we've been on the phone. I'm trying to just keep track with what the current discussion is, but I would be able to add that I don't believe that unless an individual physically has COVID-19, they probably would not qualify under the allowable absence. And as far as considering what we're going to do with a 180-day absence, I don't know what's upcoming with Representative Vance, but it is quite early, and we are open to suggestions. It's certainly a topic that we're discussing at this time.
Okay, thank you.
Other questions? Representative Hopkins.
Thank you. And this is a little off topic, so we might as well keep going, I guess. Does the department, or the division rather, have the ability to make a waiver currently under your powers for a situation like we have right now? If the flight, if this does not pass and the flights get canceled and they exceed whatever allowable absences we have now, do you guys have the ability to waive that currently for extenuating circumstances or no?
Through the chair, we do not.
All right, thank you.
Representative Vance.
Not to put him on the spot, but I'd like to hear from the maker of the bill about the version before us and any thoughts that he may have and insight, since he's been working on so many suggestions along the way. Just like to hear your insight on this CS.
Thank you very much, and thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. I appreciate the opportunity, and I appreciate the focus and attention to what I had made the mistake, of course, thinking this was going to be a very simple piece of legislation with one simple amendment. But as this obviously as this progressed, several concerns that I don't think they're new. I think there's been a lot of consideration put into these things over the years. So in working with both the chairman and the co-chairman, and also a couple of the members on maybe some amendments that might be addressed in the future. I thought it would be very appropriate to at least bring this to the table with these changes in there and have potentially a lively discussion to see where we've actually been. Some of the questions that were brought in mind when the chairman and I had our opportunity to discuss these were I had for years kind of looked at these numbers and had wondered the appropriateness behind the numbers, and like the chairman had suggested, we also talked about the potential to stack. There's always potential to stack certain things in here. And there was one point in time where I had actually gone through the statutes and thought, if the situation arose for me, I think I could stack a year and a half's worth of absence. I don't mind that so much as long as it's appropriate. But when you do put some of those things together, and you know, we don't want to bludgeon people when they're at their lowest point, or make people suffer when they're at their lowest point or anything. But I've had some personal experience dealing with a few of the things that were mentioned before, settlement of an estate and some things like that. If I read this correctly, if you stack it this way now, you may be able to have 250 total days to actually deal with that. That's a long time. That's, you know, well beyond a half a year to deal with things. And some of these, the hardest part for me was when I researched this, I wasn't sure how the numbers were arrived at to begin with. That was probably, but you know, brand new program, brand new thing. You have to have some limitation, some numbers, and that's how they came about. But I've also promised myself, ever since I've been a legislator, that I would not marry myself to my own legislation, and that the committee process is here for a reason. And when something I may have come up with advances to that point where a committee hears it, then I really do, not entirely without an opinion, but the will of the committee is what's most important to me as we work our way through this process. But some of the changes I think are appropriate. I do appreciate Representative Thompson bringing that up. I think it's probably up to the committee to have that discussion and determine some of these things. When Co-Chair Fields came to me and talked to me about that particular situation, I was more than surprised. But I think that's a very appropriate change. And the amendments that are in front of me, I can also support as well. So I hope that's been a clarifying statement. May have been more confusing than it was clarifying, but I do appreciate the committee looking into this, and I do appreciate the discussion and having a lively discussion. At that, Mr. Chairman, I will turn this over to the will of the committee and let you continue, all of you, to continue to work on this.
Thank you, Representative Tallarico. And if there are other questions, of course, we'll lean to your perspective, but other questions from the committee on the CS? Representative Vance?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. With some of the concerns that Representative Thompson brought up, we do have the applicability that these wouldn't start until essentially the deadline of next year's application. But in consideration of getting the knowledge of the changes out to the public and people's travel arrangements, many people are unlike myself and make travel arrangements a year or two in advance. Would you be up for a transition paragraph in here that made for allowances of a little bit of time to get the public caught up to what new policy is if this bill is implemented, either by adjusting, I wouldn't want to adjust the applicability. We want to start that right away. But as far as transition concerning the previous 5 years and just how all of that's stacking up because of just not wanting to spring changes on the public in their mind, giving time for people to really be informed so that they still feel a part of the process.
Yeah, thank you for the question, Representative Vance, it's a good question. I might actually turn to Director Wesky to get her perspective on, I think, the implications on transition, especially with that 4323-008D section, and get a sense if Director Wesky, what kind of, you know, complications, or do you expect complications as far as transition, were this CS to pass, particularly with that provision, but really any provision, to Representative Vance's question?
Through the chair, I'm just trying to find that right now. I'm so sorry. I'm not super familiar with this document right now. So, Dee, what page are you on?
Four.
Page four, lines 19 through 26.
So, to rephrase the question is, how could this affect the individuals who are currently out of the state and can't return? Is that the question?
No, through the chair. The question is transition from our current statute to the new qualifications. How could we provide, is it necessary for us to write in this CS a transition period so that the public can have the adjustments necessary to not suddenly be ineligible for dividends in this following year?
Thank you so much. Through the chair, I do believe that it would be reasonable to add in at least a one calendar year adjustment period, but that would be simply my own opinion of what I see. It would just give individuals an opportunity to plan for that change a little better.
Thank you. Yeah, I think that seems reasonable to me, given Director Wesky's testimony and your comment, Representative Vance. Other questions about the CS? Representative Vance?
Just one more question on with the concerns about the military in Section 1 that Representative Thompson has. You know, we're making the change in the CS from 72 consecutive hours to 7 days. I just would like to either have either testimony or a letter from military that talks about, is this possible, is this doable, because I am not familiar with military being stationed out of state and what the requirements for them are, and having a little bit more insight would be helpful to me on this decision.
Sure, Representative Vance. And Director Wesky, not that you're military, but I know you work around these eligible exemptions, the eligibility exemptions a lot. Do you have any sense to the answer to Representative Vance's question?
Chairman, I don't have a great answer for you. I think that, you know, we tried to be cautious of ensuring that we are not requiring more time in Alaska than an average military member has of leave. So that was one of the considerations. But I'm sure that based on this bill, I think 72 hours is probably an extremely safe number. But, you know, we wouldn't want to see it go above what an average military member receives for leave in the course of, say, 2 years, and then in the course of 5 years. And that would be something I think that would be best to hear also from somebody who's in the military or well-versed with that.
Representative Vance, I think we can potentially get that testimony. I think that would be helpful. Representative Hopkins, did you have a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Director, Representative Thompson was asking his questions about the Alaskan military family who's stationed outside of the state, entirely still owns a home here, still plans on having his kids come back to UAF or any of the university systems, or eventually moving back here when they retire. Those individuals who own a home here in Alaska are not the members of the military that we were talking about who never come back and continue to draw PFD, correct?
Through the chair, that would be a reasonable assumption.
can you describe to me which of these sections or which of these changes in the CS, I guess, close that loophole for those members who never plan on coming back?
Through the chair, that's a tough question. It appears to me that it would eliminate the individuals who do the bare minimum to come back to the state of Alaska. So basically what we would end up seeing is a higher level of, I guess, actions taken within the state to prove that Alaska is truly their home. A lot of military members who do have the home in Alaska rent it out, and they come back every, you know, every year, a couple years to do work on the home. And those individuals seem to have no issues being eligible under the statute as it currently stands. But I think that it would just take that one, a couple extra actions for them to be able to prove that in the future.
Follow up.
Representative Hopkins.
Thank you. I guess I'm still trying to figure it out. If that's one of our big concerns, which I absolutely share, of them never coming back to Alaska, those people currently don't come back to Alaska every 72 hours every 2 years, correct? Am I right in this one?
Through the chair, if they don't do that, they don't qualify for the PFD, and at that point their residency is broken. But we do have members who come back only for the 72 hours or only for the 30 consecutive days as it stands right now.
All right, thank you. Then one more follow-up just to make sure I understand. So those military members continue to come back at some point for 72 hours for the remainder of their life over those two-year periods?
Through the chair, that is correct.
Okay, thank you.
Can I ask a follow-up?
Representative Fields.
Okay. Ms. Wesky, perhaps I'm sure I should understand this already, but I don't. Could you understand the relationship between allowable absence number three, serving on active duty as a member of the armed forces, is or as basically a family member, and the sections that we're discussing, which I think is number 18. So why does Section 3 not kind of already provide protection for members of the military?
Through the chair, we don't have a Section 18. Are you referring to?
The days of absence. I guess what my question is, maybe let's see.
83, line 28.
Well, maybe stated differently. So, subsection 3 of Section 3, which is an allowable absence for serving on active duty or being a family member in active duty, why is that insufficient to protect a military, someone in the military and their family? Why would it matter if we went from 72 hours to 7 days, kind of in a separate category? That's what I don't understand.
Through the chair, I think that would be maybe better answered by the sponsor of that section. I'm not sure if that's a good answer, but I think the goal is just to have another layer of ensuring that these individuals are coming back to the state of Alaska. If the number of 7 consecutive days and 90, you know, the higher you get, the more guaranteed that you would be that they are truly, you know, dedicated to the state of Alaska and residents that are active here in the state. But I'm not quite sure if that's the answer you're looking for.
I think I caught your question, Representative Fields. And I mean, just to note, this provision is already in law. It's already part of the PFD eligibility statute. So I had multiple conversations with Ms. Nauman about trying to get my head around this. It's like right now you can qualify for PFDs under allowable absences, and then if you keep doing that for long enough, like you're qualifying under these allowable absences, you're not physically in Alaska, and year after year you're not physically here, but you're still collecting your PFDs under allowable absences, after a certain period of time, there then becomes this like second layer of qualification to prove that you're like actually an Alaskan. And so that's this 72-hour versus 7 consecutive day thing, and this 30 cumulative days versus 90 cumulative days thing. That's that like second layer of qualification.
Yeah.
And it only applies to people who are collecting PFD year after year after year under an allowable absence.
While not
physically being in Alaska.
Okay.
So it's basically saying like, if you're not physically in Alaska for 5 years, like, okay, we want this like second layer of like test or proof that you're serious about Alaska.
Well,
so that's what this whole provision is. It's like a second layer.
Well, with that explanation, I was fine with it before, but I certainly feel much more comfortable knowing kind of the context and that this is only applying to people who just haven't been here most of the time for a while.
And I just really want to – it took me a really long time to get my head wrapped around this. I'm just going to turn to Ms. Nauman to make sure what I said was accurate. Ms. Nauman, was that right or wrong or need to be revised, my attempted explanation to Representative Fields' question?
For the record, this is Emily, Legislative Legal Services. To the chair, yes, your explanation was correct.
Okay. Any other questions? Representative Vance.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just have a question for Ms. Nauman, and this is a clarification on Section 1. It mentioned 825 applicants that fall in that 72 consecutive year hours provision, and we're on the assumption that most of them are military. Do you know if that is accurate, or is there another category of people that we are missing in this conversation?
And that question might be best directed for Director Wesky, if you'd answer that. Director Wesky, could you answer the question?
Certainly, through the chair, Representative, that is correct.
I think Representative Vance's question is, for the people who are being affected by the 72-hour every 2 years, 30 cumulative days every 5 years provision, do you know what allowable absences those people are qualifying in? We're making the assumption kind of in this conversation that they're all military. Are there other allowable absences that
other groups of people that
might be affected
that we're thinking this is military? Is there another group of people that seem to fall in this 825 applicants category that we're just not seeing?
Yes, through the chair, we have three key categories of individuals. So military, of course, you guys got that. And the second one are students. And the third one are those with medical concerns.
Thank you for that clarification.
Other questions from the committee for Ms. Nauman, Ms. Wesky, myself? So I know we're sort of threading the needle with committees here because I know a couple members have Labor and Commerce at 3:15. What I might propose doing is that we recess and we can look to get some testimony and more insight from somebody in the military about sort of allowable or how much leave military members have every year or every 2 years, as it were. And then also that transition question that Representative Vance raised. Representative Thompson, comment or question?
Yeah, we still haven't accepted the CS as the working document. I don't want to slow this down, so I will withdraw my objection to accepting using the CS as the working document.
Okay, and I'll just object to make a brief comment, which is I'm committed not to railroad this through until we resolve these questions. So I will also withdraw my objection. Is there any further objection to adoption of version S as the working document for House Bill 190? Seeing none, version S is adopted as the working document of House Bill 190. And I'll, as I was saying before, I think maybe recess, confer with committee members when we can find more time, we can get information. And then we have these amendments from Representative Story and Representative Vance for consideration. So we will be in touch and sort of see how this day-by-day improvisation of the legislature continues. But thank you, Representative Tallarico. Thank you, Director Wesky. Ms. Nauman, and we are recessed to the call of the chair.